Now I would like to introduce Reverend Catherine Clarenbach. She's a community minister based in Portland. Her ministry includes spiritual counsel, classes, and writing. You can find out more about her ministry for you youth and seekers of all stripes at thewayoftheriver.com. She's excited to join us as a member at the start of the church year.
Our reading is by Starhawk, the eco-feminist theologian. It's called simply Community. Somewhere, there are people to whom we can speak with passion without having the words catch in our throats. Somewhere, a circle of hands will open to receive us. Eyes will light up as we enter. Voices will celebrate with us whenever we come into our power. Community means strength that joins our strength to do the work that needs to be done. Arms to hold us when we falter. A circle of healing. A circle of friends. Someplace where we can be free. This sermon is in honor of the first male couple in history we know by name. Manicurists of King Nusayre of Egypt in the 5th century, 5th dynasty, circa 2400 BCE. They were buried as other married couples of the royal household were, and their names were inscribed together. Wish me luck. Khnumhotep and Nianzukhnum. In their memory then, in honor of Khnumhotep and Nianzukhnum, I offer this sermon on the superpowers of queer community. And while the superpowers I identify today are by no means unique to LGBTQ people and individuals, they are significant because they have sustained us in community and as individual people through oppression, criminalization, and even martyrdom. The superpowers I offer today are only a few of those I could choose. Reclamation of words that have been used against us. The courage to be ourselves when others would put our star-shaped pegs into round holes, or square holes, or square spaces that tried to contain us. Working in solidarity when our queer family needed us. And the mystical power of this strange, bent, queer family I am so proud of, one I had the good fortune to come into, and would choose and choose and choose again. I begin then with my own place, my own history, and my own coming out, that superpower of its own, the self-reflection and expression of an often unexpected interior reality. We begin in the year of my coming out, 1990. From 1990 to 1995, I was very involved in HIV/AIDS education and activism, as well as queer activism. I was part of that generation that publicly began reclaiming words like queer, like dyke, faggot, and sissy. Words that had been part of historically knocking us down in the schoolyard, on the streets, in restaurants, in workplaces, potentially anywhere we went. We took them back using the tools of the radical feminists of the 1970s and 80s who had taken back words like witch, hag, and crone. We used the words that had been used against us, and we imbued them with magic, boldness, and daring. We said, yes, we're queer. No, we're not like the ones who insist on heteronormativity and conformity. And yes, we're coming for you if you have demands that we straighten up, cover up, put away our leather and our rhinestones, our sequins and our motorcycles. Yes, we are the sissies, the dykes you beat up or tried to on the playground. As we said in nearly every demonstration I led in those days, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. This piece of our story brings me to another one of the superpowers of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer communities. Solidarity. Lesbians and other queer women joined the battle against AIDS throughout the 80s and 90s. And so I, no heroine, drawn along by my community, rose up side by side with others. It was gay men like Larry Kramer who founded Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP in New York City. Still, organizations like GMHC, ACT UP, and many other direct service AIDS service organizations, like the one I worked for, were often staffed primarily by queer women. My friends, teachers, and classmates were getting sick all around me. They were dying. And so the times called for both ends of the struggle. We worked hard to educate people gently in churches and in schools, and to hold the hands of the dying and the bereaved. And we were also civilly disobedient, religiously disruptive, and politically demanding. Even before those harrowing times, despite being trained as all oppressed groups are in horizontal hostility and backbiting, born of internalized self-hatred, queer people have come to one another's aid again and again. The bars and restaurants that were mid-century battlegrounds in the 20th century weren't particularly divided by gender. They were safer places than many, and the only places beside private homes where many of my forebears, our queer forebears, could feel like themselves. In the late 50s, 1950s that is, when fights first began breaking out with police who raided queer bars, it was the Bulldaggers and drag queens who fought back. And in 1966 and 69, when the most famous riots, the Compton Cafeteria Riot in San Francisco and the Stonewall Rebellion, which went on for days, it was most especially trans people of color who put their bodies on the line. People who then may have identified as drag queens, butches, and their often socially invisible femme lovers, threw rocks, broke windows, and fought the police with broken beer bottles and their own hands, feet, and high-heeled shoes. This history is recent. This is history every single adult in this room should already know. But these qualities, these superpowers of courage, go back much farther even than when lesbians swelled the ranks of the military during World War II. That same war that had drag shows put on for military entertainment, And when service members put on switched wedding shows for fun, the superpower of courage when it counts goes back generations, centuries, even millennia. So to return briefly to the beginning of our tale, I quote for you a line we often use in our work in Queer Nation, our work as friends, lovers, and chosen siblings fighting side by side. An army of lovers cannot fail. The ancient Greek idea of the army of lovers had been, for me, like stories of my heroines, the Amazons, Penthesilea, and Hippolyta. They were a powerful, inspiring myth, an ideal, an image of the force of love doing good, struggling for what they needed. But what I didn't know is that there actually was a real regiment of lovers, known for their military expertise and power as far back as the 4th century before the Common Era. That is to say, before much of the Bible, as we know it, was written, before the destruction of the Second Temple and the rise of rabbinical Judaism, before Muhammad, before Jesus and the Marys of Nazareth, Magdala, and Bethany. This elite regiment was a sacred band of thieves. That's with a B, not thieves. They were 100 couples of men, one of each pair identified as lover, the other as beloved, and they were undefeated in battle for over 30 years. They fought from 378 BCE to 341, when their shock troops were destroyed by Philip of Macedon's army. And when Philip recognized the special identity of the army his men had defeated, he declared a state of mourning in their honor. According to Plutarch, Philip went as far as to say, quote, "Perish any man who suspects that these men, this sacred band, either did or suffered anything unseemly." The army of lovers were, for me, when I found out about them, courage incarnate, fighting side by side, back to back, accountable for the lives and well-being of their comrades. The army of lovers, and all of us who called on their ancestral power, even when we didn't know they really existed, were imbued with the power of love to bolster loyalty and courage. These qualities of loyalty and courage are two of the great superpowers of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people across time and space, history, and nation. Again, even as backbiting, horizontal hostility, and self-hatred had been beaten into so many of us, still, there is an example of loyalty to common cause and courage in all kinds of circumstances. When it comes to courageous self-expression under scrutiny, contemporary examples abound. The unabashedly pierced and tattooed, mermaid-haired youth and young adults, and often not so young, sporting beards and skirts who are gender non-binary, a legal gender identity in Oregon, the first state in the Union to legally acknowledge such an identity. These folks, non-binary, trans, or just plain queer as F, come immediately to mind, especially in a city where more than the average number of white queer folks feel safe expressing themselves. But trans women of color, And often trans women who are out and recognizable are murdered at a shocking rate all over the country, including here, in our oh-so-progressive city. In May of this year, Gigi Pierce was shot and killed downtown. This spring, when the flowers began their gorgeous procession, in this city, on our streets, she died. Not only that, since 2013, Human Rights Campaign has recorded at least 102 murders of transgender people in the United States, and 88% of those people were transgender women, and 87% of all the victims were people of color. Gigi's death marks the 11th transgender homicide in the U.S. in 2018, based on HRC data. And yet, these queer siblings of mine continue to transition, to use the magic of shape-shifting, of hiding in plain sight, or blowing the door off the closet, at home, at work, and on the streets of our cities. They continue to express their real selves, the genders they have known for years or have grown to understand, and they take their risks every day. But not all the stories of queer superpowers are about struggle. Some are about the power of recognition. Some stories of queer superpowers are about cultures recognizing the edge walkers and the shapeshifters, people who live in the sexual borderland. In many cultures, we are seen not only as different, but special, worthy, and even especially accountable to the divine powers. These people in between the boundaries of sexuality and gender may even be brought up from childhood by spiritual teachers into significant religious and spiritual roles in their cultures. Here in the Americas, within just the last 50 years, a pan-Indigenous group agreed by consensus to call the myriad people who occupy genders other than simply male or female as two-spirit people. Before the use of two-spirit, most white people used the colonial term berdash, which is neither correct nor respectful. It is important for me to mention, as I read over and over again, that two-spirit people, whether assigned female or male at birth, are not simply gay Indians, but rather have traditional social and ceremonial roles acknowledged by the elders of their particular communities. And I note an example. In 1886, a Zuni two-spirit person, originally assigned male at birth, was received in the White House by then President Grover Cleveland as an Indian princess. A very confusing situation. To find other examples of spiritually significant queer-identified people, we can go back much further and venture to ancient Phrygia. The reigning mother goddess of Phrygia was Cybele, and her worship was hundreds of years old by the time the Romans appropriated it in 204 BCE. And the most visible worshippers of Cybele were, and her consort, Attis, were called the Galli. They are some of my favorite people. The Galli, in 204, were recognized as the keepers of Cybele's ministries. And the head Gallus, their leader, a Roman citizen, was recognized as a civic leader under civil law. The Gali were the greatest drag queens of all time. They were assigned male at birth, but as they grew into the priesthood, some of them castrated themselves, emulating the story of Addis. But whether they did that or not, the Gali wore long, shimmering yellow robes, makeup, and bleached wigs, and they danced in the streets, playing tambourines and singing. They begged for food and money and told the fortunes of those who supported them. And it is not only the human devotees of spirit who twist and play with gender and sexuality, but deities themselves are often as queer as can be. Gender-bending deities abound throughout both the ancient and contemporary world. From India to Japan, back to ancient Greece and Sumer, and all over the ancient Near East, as well as in the Americas, spiritual images and roles of gender-bending and same-sex attraction abound. Clearly, queer deities, our queer ancestors, and many queer people today occupy special, even central roles in religious and spiritual community. Gender-benders, trans people, and those with a range of sexual attraction make it crystal clear that sexuality and gender have always been significant concerns, whether they were supported and held up or suppressed and put down in religions all over the world. In our own religious tradition, we are largely and rightly proud of our support of gay and lesbian rights. Unitarian Universalism was the first mainstream religious organization to ordain gay and lesbian ministers. And UUs, as you know, were at the forefront of the struggle for marriage equality. And yet we still struggle. I have read congregational records in which search committees were instructed not even to interview trans or bisexual candidates. In the last 5 years, in our tradition. Similarly, UU congregations sometimes have a hard time fully and warmly welcoming trans congregants. And many of us, not just UUs, struggle and stumble over ourselves in a seemingly more and more complex world of pronouns and creative assertions of identity. Nevertheless, queer communities continue to exercise our superpower of radical reinvention with new language, new ideas, new ways of articulating differences in feeling, self-expression, and politics. Religious communities, even ours, can have trouble keeping up. The thing is, though, none of this is new. None of this is new. Not really. It's as ancient as human self-expression, love, courage, spirituality, and solidarity. Reinvention, reclamation, all of it, all these superpowers have been with us all along. We just need to pay closer attention. So I give honor to our queer ancestors, my own and those of each and every person in this room. I give thanks for their gifts, for their struggles, their hiddenness, and their blatant difference. I thank my STEM ancestors, so often still invisible as the queer women we are, our manicured nails beating a tattoo of care for our lovers on the glasses we've held. I bless all of us in the names of Tnumhotep and Nyanjanum, and every member of every army of lovers that has ever been.
We have time for questions or comments. I will bring the mic to you, and Catherine will answer or Scott.
Thank you. I have a comment and maybe two comments and kind of a question-ish. But the first thing is I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, and there's a fairly large Unitarian church there. And around the time I was graduating and moving out here, my mom had said, and it had been a very welcoming congregation, my mom had said that there was a decline in the attendance and I think membership of heterosexual couples because it almost became too gay. And it became very uncomfortable for a lot of folks that just didn't know how to deal with that and becoming... I don't know necessarily what the, again, this was during the time that I was moving out here, so I don't know what the percentage breakdown was, but it was an interesting thing to me that my mom had continued to go, but said that it was an uncomfortable time because then you lose some of the long-term members and the people that were newer, both gay and straight, that were there. I think it became kind of a tormented time for him, and it was just an interesting thing for me to try to reconcile, you know, you want to be welcoming, but those changes can sometimes bring unintended, uncomfortable consequences. The other part of it, too, was unrelated, was on Saturday, or Friday night, as my daughter mentioned, I was at the PCC graduation. And each of the speakers there began their comments with, this is my name and my pronouns are her or she, her and hers or him, you know. So anyway, what was interesting, their mom leaned over to me and said, what is this all about? And it became a distraction from the message. And to me, I had a conversation with my oldest son afterwards saying, you know, how do you make sure that people get the value they need and the recognition that they need and being addressed as who they are inside without deterring from the message. And I imagine it's just going to be an adjustment period. Do you envision a time or a way that it doesn't need to be that difficult conversation to get to the message that person is trying to get to. Sorry.
No, that was lovely. That was lovely. And the answer is we have to be uncomfortable. You answered your own question. We need to be uncomfortable, many of us, in order to get to a place where we don't assume that someone sits in a certain box or acts in a certain way or chooses a certain pronoun. I worked in my spiritual practice with someone who you would look at and say, this person was clearly assigned female at birth, is a woman, I know, she has a very clearly womanly name, a queenly name, in fact, and she's not that. They are not that. For them, when people call them by the wrong pronoun, they said, it's like they've forgotten my name. And I think, as I said, all of us, many of us, not all of us, but many of us stumble and struggle. I was raised by English teachers, okay? So I am sensitive to... Okay, they is okay, I can do this, I'm tripping, it's okay. But the fact is that they and them have been used as singular pronouns since the 16th century. Something I didn't mention in my sermon. But in all kinds of contexts. So the answer is that we need to be uncomfortable. And if we look at the integration of other groups and the struggle of other groups, we know that people with power and privilege have to be uncomfortable for a while, have to give up something that they have had in order to make room so that eventually we're not assumed to all be the same. So thank you for your comments and your questions.
Thank you, Catherine. That was a very interesting history that I was unaware of, going back 2.5 millennia. My question is, the United Nations, does the Commission on Human Rights recognize the need here, and do they address it throughout the world through the 200-some member nations?
I know that there are people on the Commission for Human Rights, but someone else in this room can probably answer this question better than I can. Does anyone know the answer to this question? I can speak to the World Council of Churches. I had an experience, and I could imagine this happening at the United Nations as well. I had an experience sitting in my systematic theology class, listening to a representative of the World Council of Churches talking about their love and justice initiative and their love and justice committee that did not include me, that did not include people like me. And it was because they were afraid of losing Orthodox and evangelical members of the World Council of Churches. So until and unless people are willing to say it's more important that we be loving and just than that we include people who will not be loving and just, we're going to be still having this problem. But I don't know the answer to your question. I just know an analogous answer. I'm sorry.
I just have two comments. I really appreciated you mentioning all the work that lesbians did for the gay male community during the AIDS crisis, because that just, a lot of people don't realize that. We lost an entire generation of gay men. That's why you don't really see any gay elders, and lesbians had to fill in for that role. So I really appreciated hearing that. And I also appreciated you not skirting around the words that were being reclaimed, because as a young gay man in Texas, whenever I was a teenager, I was called faggot all the time, like constantly. And whenever I could finally call myself that and it not feel like a sting, that's whenever I was like, okay, I can be fully myself. So I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Were you down at the trans march yesterday by any chance?
I was not.
Oh.
If there had been a car.
There was.
As someone else mentioned.
There was.
I hadn't known about it.
Yeah.
I would have certainly been.
Okay, well, they always have two, actually.
Great.
But I just wanted to recommend going to the Trans March for everyone and anyone, because our cultural socialization just you know, is there with our visualization. You know, we've been trained binary. It's such an effort to make something that's that ingrained reset. But I found it so easy when I was there for several hours learning amazing amounts of history from all different aspects, because after a while there are so many different types of thin and fat and tall and short and bearded and unbearded, and your mind just stops trying to put people into categories. It's just too diverse, and your mind just says, fine, people. And I almost could feel my mind click, because it just couldn't happen anymore. So we were there with the Raging Grannies, and it's the best place to be, because we throw kisses at all these people and say we love you, and they just love us all back. So it's a great place to go.
That's great. That's great. When you talk about your mind clicking, right, the trick is, for me at least, has been to try and keep the click, right, to stay there. Because folks know, folks especially who use they and them pronouns, or folks who are transitioning, they know that people are going to stumble. It's okay to mess up. What is desired is respect and love, and to say, oh, I'm sorry, I'll try to do better next time.
I'd like to make a comment. I'm interested in how to make social change easier. I'd like to show some perfect example. Like, I come from a traditional Chinese family. My mother was an educated woman in China. And in her culture, they had, you know, choose your wife or husband by the family or friends. They didn't trust outside people. Like, they didn't particularly care for white women or European women because they felt their custom would not make for a stable marriage. And in some other side, we hear all these horses about female genitalization and honor killing. But in those cultures, it serves a certain function. Like, for example, I remember in some countries where they have female genitalization, they want to keep them, quote, pure, because it doesn't make a sense that how it affects the ability of their family to have husbands and wives. So if you want to change that custom, you have to make a condition where a woman who's uncircumcised will make no consequence in their society. So until this is changed, you have resistance. Like in my own family, they didn't want me to white marry a person who is not Chinese. And most of us, you know, have Chinese wives. But as times change, as your, I think my mother's family, we had some people who marry white people, white Americans, and Chinese, and you say, who gets divorced, who doesn't get divorced, who take it all, you know. And as these things change, then the people of the other culture will be more adaptable. I mean, like, first, like, one of the most horrible things I can think of is the World War II, when the Germans picked up the Jews and put them in gas chamber. And Hitler was able to do this because the circumstances in Germany was such that they felt they got a raw deal from World War I.
Yeah.
And some of them really believed that the Jews were, you know, hurting Germany. So until you change these belief systems, you can't have change. You can't have them in society. So in order for us to have change, you would make it easier for the dumb society to change.
You know, you mentioned something early in your comments that made me think of something that's very common today even, and has been common in many, many cultures, which is that traditional marriage between a man and a woman, if that's the tradition, you know, monogamy, on the public side, was often also included with particularly husbands having acknowledged male lovers. Marriage and sexual activity or attraction were, and sometimes are, considered two separate issues, which is just something that your comment made me think of.
One more question. I just have two short comments. One about, well, they're both about the willingness to be uncomfortable and the necessity of just get used to it, you know, and that for every kind of progress, there's got to be this awkward transition that's almost by definition, and we're the lucky ones who get to be in that awkward position. And I'm an editor. I work for a scientific publisher,
nothing to do with political activism or anything like that. Science, hard science. In our grammar handbook, we have just recently made the official house style change that the gender neutral pronoun is they. And we don't change he to he or she or anything like that. We use they because we're trying to get used to it. The other thing I wanted to say is amplifying on what Tom said about the awkwardness. My father, who was born in 1937 and died just a few years ago, was horrified by gay rights and gay marriage. I just thought that was just disgusting. And he was a very smart guy, so he came up with legalistic and intellectual reasons. And it was actually while at the very end of his life, he briefly lived here in Portland and came to WUF often, and it just, he was kind of coming around anyway, but it happened to be at a WUF sermon that he finally tipped off the edge, where Dad and I went out to lunch afterwards, and he said, "The only real reason I'm against gay marriage is that I think homosexuality is disgusting, and you can't legislate on the basis of personal disgust. That is no basis for law." And it wasn't actually that his gut feeling had changed at all. He had just decided, my gut feeling I'm just going to have to live with, because that's not a legitimate reason to decide what is just in a society. And the postscript is that he realized how hypocritical it was, because there were plenty of people who were disgusted by his marriage to my mother. Mm-hmm. He was Japanese, she was Caucasian, and they were married in the 1950s, very soon after the war. There were plenty of people who were horrified by that. His own family was a little skeeved out that he had not married Japanese. Mm-hmm. So who was he to talk? And I really appreciated that he was the one who came around to that at the age of 83.
I just want to mention, as a postscript to your commentary, one of the things that I think we often do, especially those of us who are considered to be young or younger, or is we say, "Oh, well, this person is X older age. They're not going to change. They're stuck in whatever ideas they have." My wife's grandmother lived to be 102, and she lived through World War II and was an amazing woman, Anneliese Clarenbach. She blessed us with her name. And she would call and ask Julie, "Oh, tell me, how is your mate?" And it was, you know, that was language that she had, that she used, that she had worked out for herself. And so I don't know where she stood when she was 40 years younger or 50 years younger, but at the age of 101, she was asking after my wife's wife.
Thank you, Catherine.